You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When there's big news about the Arctic sea ice, and there is, who else to call but Paul Beckwith? He's the double master's man working on his PhD in climatology at the University of Ottawa. Paul has been watching the Arctic ice closely for years. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
There is big news about the Arctic, although I suppose it's not really news to you and maybe not even to me, but tell us what NASA is reporting, please.
Well, very recently, NASA, a SIRS satellite, has been recording the albedo. So the albedo is basically the percentage of reflected light from a surface. And satellites have been recording data since 1979, and the Arctic reflectivity of the whole region was about 52%. And more recently, in 2011, I believe, the reflectivity of the Arctic has dropped to 48%. So the Arctic is getting darker, so it's absorbing more light. And this is one of the prime reasons that the Arctic temperature is amplified at much, much higher rates than that of the global average.
Well, look, this idea that it's dropped from 52% in 1979 to 48% in 2011, that doesn't sound like such a big deal. It's just 4%. Why is NASA coming out and reporting this?
The change in reflectivity is 4%. But if you take it in terms of, you know, when we normally think of percentages, a change from 52 to 48 is actually a change of 8%. And I'm not talking about reflectivity here. I'm just talking about normal percentages. So, you know, 8% is approaching 10%. This represents an additional forcing to the climate system, a forcing making the temperature rise. And if you average the Arctic effect over the entire planet and compare it to the rise of temperature, the forcing from CO2 emissions into the atmosphere since 79 to 2011, then this reflectivity drop in the Arctic represents about a quarter of the effect of the CO2. So the CO2 has caused, say, 1 unit of warming since 79 to 2011, and the Arctic albedo change has caused 0.25 or 25% of the warming. So it's a very significant factor. It's higher than a lot of scientists and NASA people have expected, but being a member of AMEG, we carried out these calculations several years ago, and it's no surprise to us. I mean, it's part of the reason why we're so concerned about the changes in the Arctic and how that will affect the global changes.
Well, yes, you raised the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, or AMEG, and that includes the ice specialist Peter Wadhams at Cambridge. He's quite famous for his work. And you've been ringing the alarm bells about the importance of dwindling ice cover for years. And most of us have experienced this recently, though, Paul, as changes in the jet stream bringing extreme weather events in North America, Europe, and Asia. As a bit of a sidelight, could you run us through that quickly again?
Yes. So humans have changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. Our emissions from fossil fuel combustion have added greenhouse gases. So we've changed the physical chemistry of the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is absorbing a lot more heat, and the temperature is rising, but the temperature doesn't rise uniformly. The temperature change in the equatorial regions is relatively small. The temperature rises in the Arctic, high Arctic, are much, much larger, 5, 6, 7, 8 times higher than the global average. Land temperatures are rising more than ocean temperatures. So there's variability, you know, about the average, of course. The key factor that is changing is the temperature gradient between the equator and the North Pole. And because that temperature gradient is decreasing, so the temperature, when you have a temperature gradient, it determines heat flow. So heat always flows from hot areas to cold areas. And if the temperature difference is larger, there's more heat flow. So the heat wants to flow from the equator to the Arctic via the atmospheric wind patterns, circulation patterns, and also by ocean currents. So because that temperature gradient has decreased between the Arctic and North Pole, then there's less heat flowing from the equator to the North Pole. So the jet streams, and whenever air moves in the northern hemisphere, it deflects right because of the rotation of the Earth, something called the Coriolis force. So the jet streams are formed because of that heat flow northward, and because there's less heat flow northward, there's less volume in the jet stream. So the jet streams, that can be reflected by a decrease in cross-sectional area of the jet streams or decrease in speed or both. So what we're seeing is a decrease in speed, and because the speed is decreasing, because of conservation of angular momentum, some physics, the jet streams have to become slow down, become curvier, and their location is more dependent on land-ocean contrast. So the jet streams are becoming very broken up and fractured and very, very wavy. This is leading to different weather conditions. So the statistics of the climate have changed, and the weather events all occur within that system, so they are changing. And because of the overall warming, there's about 4 or 5% more water vapor in the atmosphere than there was in 79. So this is also more water vapor in the air. When it condenses to form clouds, it releases the energy. So there's more energy in the atmosphere, and the storms are moving slowly, and they're tracking to different locations as they follow the jet streams, which are in different locations.
Yes, for the poor people in Britain, they know that very well, and it's very unevenly distributed. I mean, California's dry and Britain is soaked. But this new study, if I understand it correctly, it means a lot more than just unstable or bad weather further south. If you're talking about a quarter of all the forces that we generate by fossil fuel emissions, you're talking about global impacts, a completely changing climate.
Yes, this is the key issue. I mean, we've changed the properties of different locations of the Earth to light. We've changed the albedo is the reflectivity. So we've changed the distribution of temperatures. So it's no surprise that the weather is also changing. I mean, I'm very convinced that we've crossed a threshold or tipping point, and we're in early stages of an abrupt climate change event, and it will take us within a decade or two to a much warmer planet, one where there's much less latitudinal temperature change. So in other words, the Arctic will be much, much warmer. The jet streams will be completely configured completely differently, and our climate will be completely changed. And originally, I thought that this would require extremely large methane emissions from the Arctic to swing us this way, and that may still be the case, but I'm not. What I'm seeing, what we're seeing is because of these massive extremes and these massive waves in the jet stream, that's a very, very strong feedback to mix warmer air from further south with the colder air from the Arctic, you know, effectively smearing out the temperature difference between those two regions. So I see the massive cold spells across the U.S. and the very warm temperatures high in the Arctic. We're talking about 20 degrees Celsius positive anomalies above average in the Arctic and 20 degrees C below average anomalies when those people call it the polar vortex came south and visited the U.S. This is a huge mixing of cold air and warm air with latitude. And it does lead to, it's very strong feedback effect in itself.
It shouldn't be happening. Now, getting back to AMIG, you have suggested on this program as well that we need to rescue the sea ice as a priority, if necessary, using geoengineering such as spraying sulfate particles to halt the decline, at least temporarily. Does this new NASA report strengthen your case for that?
Yes, it absolutely strengthens it. You know, this new NASA report has just been out a few days, and there's already been numerous blogs and things on it. And there was one blog in particular that was saying that, like, the NASA measurements are the reflectivity of the whole Arctic, and it was believed at one point that as the sea ice declined and there was more open water, the higher evaporation would lead to more low-level clouds, which reflect light, so would in some way compensate for this loss of albedo change. I mean, that may be occurring. Maybe the loss of reflectivity or albedo from the sea ice is more than the 4%. Maybe it's some of it's being compensated by more clouds, but the net effect is the 4% of albedo drop. So the article was saying, well, maybe cloud seeding or putting albedo in the Arctic would not help. It doesn't say that the geoengineering methods to brighten the Arctic and reflect more light won't work. It just says it's not happening naturally because of the cloud formation. So I haven't changed any of my position that I had 2 years ago. What I've just seen is that the system is accelerating at an ever faster rate. I mean, the climate system is changing. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that the whole system was undergoing an abrupt change a few years ago, but that's what I see now. And I'm quite prolific with YouTube videos, and I did one of just a few days ago talking about how the extreme weather and the climate, you know, how this is evolving in the future as I see it. You know, what's our planet going to look like in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
And we need to know that. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. You know, Paul, most of climate science, including the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, have been busy calculating, here's so much change for so many barrels of oil or tons of coal burned, and now we find there's a huge feedback from the emerging dark surface of the Arctic Sea. How will that change the emphasis in climate science?
I think that we're nearing a tipping point in public behavior and understanding of climate science, and it is getting to political leaders. I mean, you have people like John Kerry saying that, you know, climate change is a huge threat. You have the military with many reports saying that, you know, climate change is a very strong threat multiplier. You know, a lot of people are getting extremely, extremely concerned about, you know, how, I mean, it's obvious that things are changing very, very quickly. It's obviously that things are not right. And like countries like Britain are bearing the brunt right now, and then it will switch to some other country. You know, think of it as the climate casino, you know, which country is unlucky in the climate casino. I mean, for January and February, it was Britain, you know, as well as many countries in South America where there's been massive flooding. In the U.S., it's the, you know, California. I mean, the food, you know, and how it will affect people, you know, is the food supply. I mean, even in the Ukraine, when there were problems, you know, a few number of years ago, and it was the Orange Revolution, food prices had spiked up a lot before that happened. And, you know, when people have trouble paying for food, they go into the streets and they, you know, demand change from the government. I don't know, you know, the situation enough there to say that this is the same sort of thing, but I know it happened with the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine a number of years ago. So, you know, there's a lot of we should probably have a separate session on geopolitics.
Absolutely. You know, I do want to get into one thing that you've kind of brought up, which is where could we go? And my guest this week, author Giles Slade, says that birds and fish are starting to move northward towards the poles, and humans will start that trek as well within our lifetimes. He thinks there will be an exodus from Southern America into Canada as climate refugees, and maybe from Africa and the Middle East towards Scandinavia, Britain, or Siberia. What do you think? Is he going too far or too fast when he talks like that?
No, I mean, we definitely see animals migrating. Plants and animals, flora and fauna, they're used to a certain temperature regime, you know, a swing from a certain low temperature to high temperature. And all of those particular environments are moving poleward. They're moving poleward or they're moving up in altitude. So there's definitely migrations going on. Human migrations, yes. But I suspect that most of the human migrations will be from rising sea level. Well over a billion people live within 25 meters of sea level, present sea level, and hundreds of million live within about a meter. So countries like Bangladesh, parts of Europe, there's many, many cities on coasts. And, you know, this is another separate topic. Hansen thinks that we'll have up to 5 meters of sea level rise by 2100. My estimate is higher. I'm saying 7 meters by 2070. And again, this would be another show to discuss, you know, how I'm coming up with those numbers. But we do know, you know, the models on sea level rise aren't the way to go. You look at what happened in history. You look at the other warm periods on the planet. For example, the Eemian 130,000 years ago, sea levels were 4 to 6 meters higher. Average temperatures were only about a degree higher. If you go to the Pliocene, where it was 2-3 degrees warmer, sea levels were 25 meters higher. Even at the end of the last ice age, I mean, the sea level has been fairly stable for the last 7,000 years, except since 1750, 1800, and, you know, now the rates are climbing. But there are periods since the last ice age when sea level rose about a meter every 20 years, and this happened over several centuries. So that's 5 meter rise in sea level per century, and this happened over 2 or 3 centuries. And we know this. In fact, when sea level stabilized around 7,000 years ago and didn't rise that much more, then coastlines became much more, the fish on coastlines became much more abundant. It allowed people to live near the coastlines and get high food. You know, it was very easy to get food from fishing. So this allowed, you know, the first cities that formed when civilization was developing, it was every, you know, the entire group of people didn't have to scavenge and hunt for food. They could just fish and get it. So then people had time to do other things. So civilization, there's a strong case that Hansen makes that when sea level stabilized, that was a big factor in development of civilization. So sea level rise is, you know, a huge factor, and, you know, it's a very nonlinear factor. I mean, we know the melt rates are going up significantly. You know, if the Arctic sea ice is gone in 2016, according to the Maslowski model, you know, for the first time in September, you know, we're going to get a skyrocketing of temperature in the Arctic, you know, above and beyond what we've seen, and this can, you know, this will soften ice shells vanish, they no longer buttress the ice caps, and we can get very massive increases in sea level rise back to, and this has happened. I mean, we have the numbers from the paleo records, so you know, that's going to be the cause of most of the human migration.
Well, that pretty well agrees with what we heard last week from our guest from Berlin, Jochen Hinkel, who was talking about the huge costs in their report that they did for the Global Climate Forum of rising sea levels, and he said he thought that would be the single biggest impact of climate change, and that sea level would drive people around rather than the heat. I mean, people live in Saudi Arabia right now, and as long as we can keep the air conditioners going, I guess people will try to adapt to the heat, although I doubt that our food supply will adapt to it. We've got to wrap it up there, Paul. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Paul is from the University of Ottawa. Don't miss his super active Facebook page, which is almost a climate news service in itself. I'll put links to Paul and his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.